After watching the streaming wars play out over a number of years, there have been more signs of industry rationality of late with price increases, platform partnership, and a potential consolidation. That said, competition for eyeballs remains high. So what are the latest trends shaping the streaming industry? Welcome to Research Recap on JP Morgan's Making Sense podcast channel. I'm Jack Atherton, and I cover TMT specialist sales here at JP Morgan. Today, I'm joined by two of my colleagues in research, Doug Amuth, head of US Internet Research, and David Karnofsky, head of the US Media, Entertainment, and Advertising team. And we're here to discuss the key trends we're seeing in the streaming world today. Hi, Doug and David. Thanks for joining me.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Jack.
Doug, I'm going to come to you first. Can you give us a broad overview of the state of the streaming industry today and who the key players are?
Absolutely. In terms of the key players, there's really a handful that we really think about. Certainly Netflix as the leader and having the most subscribers on a global basis, with Disney Plus, Amazon through Prime Video, Apple Plus, HBO with Max. And I'd also add, of course, Hulu and probably Peacock as well. So probably those top seven, I would say. I think the key thing is we're kind of in the next phase of streaming, in my view. You probably had around 10 years or so of very strong secular growth. And that, of course, played into COVID and a large degree of pull forward during that period as well. Into this next phase of growth in streaming, there's certainly more growth to be had, but you're also seeing strategy shift somewhat as companies look to evolve their strategies a little bit more toward paid sharing, which is really cracking down, of course, on password sharing and advertising tiers as well, for example, and pricing also just becoming a much bigger part of the strategy here.
Fantastic. David, you publish a quarterly consumer survey focused on streaming trends. What does that say about churn rates and the number of services that each household is taking? And within that, do you think the introduction of cheaper ad-funded services is having a positive effect on the number of subscriptions people can pay for?
Yeah, sure. So we've been doing survey work for a little over 2 years now. It's pretty consistent that the average household takes between 4 and 5 services. That peaked close to 5 at the end of 2022, bottomed in 2023 around 4. It's kind of back in the middle now. We have seen a little bit of a break in the typical seasonality recently, and I do think the increasing availability of ad tiers is playing into that. Our surveys recently show, at least for Netflix and Disney Plus, that a not insignificant portion of new subscribers to those services, I think it's something in like the 20 to 30% range, are joining because of the ad tier. And I think you kind of have to remember too, there's a portion of subs out there that are getting access to these services now, whether they like it or not. So if you get your pay TV through Charter, for instance, you likely now also have access to Disney Plus with ads. With regards to churn, varies by service. In our survey work, usually 10 to 25% of respondents will express some likelihood of canceling a subscription over the near term. None of the public companies we look at ever disclose churn. I think the legacy media companies have been pretty clear. It is a tremendous challenge, and we'll likely get to it later, but that is why they are looking to increasingly bundle their services.
Cool. I'm sure we'll get back to that bundling point and where it's heading. So Doug, as you said, we're moving into the next phase for the streaming world. We're out of the low rates, growth at all costs environment. And as companies have needed to pull back investment in order to drive margins and profitability, how do you think that's impacted content investment?
I think it's still certainly very competitive around content, still for sure. But if we go back a few years and think about what we saw during COVID period, plus a lot of the traditional media companies really ramping up their streaming strategies and being more aggressive around content, that has certainly pulled back some more recently and just fits, of course, with the broader narrative across the space and really the market overall in terms of being increasingly disciplined. So right now, I think we're at a period where it's shifted a little bit more toward a buyer's market in a lot of respects. And some of that, of course, will depend on what type of content we're talking about. But I do think we're seeing companies that are able to be more selective with the content that they're buying, certainly. And I think in some cases, shifting terms from what has been in the last few years, perhaps more upfront type of spending toward more success-based and toward the back end a little bit as well.
So moving to sports, Sports content has been the final lifeline of linear, and we're seeing more and more content move to streaming, driven by big tech. So Amazon Prime has taken Thursday Night Football, YouTube has taken the Sunday Ticket, both the NFL, Apple has taken the MLB and the MLS, and even Netflix is starting to dabble with sports with the WWE and celebrity boxing. And just last night, there was news that Netflix is also in talks with the NFL to take two games on Christmas Day starting this year. Doug, coming to you, do you expect this investment to continue? And how do you think about the economics of these investments?
I absolutely think it will increase from here. So I think that now it certainly may look like small investments. And I think really you can go back over a number of years where there's been perhaps a lot of trial, and it's really been on both sides, right? I think a lot of the leagues have wanted to make sure that they could have good experiences with some of the streaming platforms, both from a production and actual technology perspective to driving a strong audience, for example. And so I think the efforts here have certainly built, but I would expect going forward, as I think about the streaming platforms and really two big things. One, their ability to have scale on a global basis, which I think will only become more important to the leagues over time. And second, the ability to pay for content and be very competitive on that front, which of course brings up a lot of the issues as linear TV shrinks and of course the growth that we're seeing on the streaming side. So those two factors I think will be very important, and I think will push the streaming players further into sports over time. And I do certainly think that we can start to see some of the leverage shift a little bit in that relationship over time.
Great. And coming to you, David, with a follow-up, how are the media companies responding and pivoting here? And then what are you hearing ahead of the NBA talks that are ongoing at the moment?
Yeah, it's definitely been a challenge for the legacy media firms in that I'm sure they would have preferred to have reduced their prices paid to sports leagues as the linear ecosystem has been under pressure, and having that digital entrance has kept pricing, or in a lot of cases, created pricing pressure, much to the happiness of the leagues. To what extent have they reacted? I think what you've seen largely is a pivot for them, basically focusing on the properties that really move the needle for them in terms of distribution and advertising, and then maybe allowing certain things that are secondary or tertiary to move away. So I'll give you a good example. One is Fox, right? They maintain a core offering around the NFL, college football, MLB, NASCAR. They currently carry WWE, but they have decided to allow that property to go away. Netflix will take that starting in early 2025. And then some NASCAR inventory also moved away, part of it to Amazon. Regarding your second question on the NBA, it's changing a lot. It's pretty fluid. The latest chatter we've heard in the trade press is that ESPN and I think Amazon have deals lined up with the league. I think Disney said as much on their earnings call or expressed a lot of confidence around it. At least the outstanding question now is what happens with the third package of rights? Turner or WBD is an incumbent there. We have seen reports that NBC has put in a soft offer for a package around $2.5 billion. That would be around twice as much as what Warner Brothers pays right now. And those games could be potentially carried on some combination of the NBC broadcast network and Peacock. Now, the incumbent Warner, they do have matching rights, as they pointed out on their earnings call last night. The question, though, is how much do those matching rights apply, in the sense that if NBC is structuring their bid around broadcast and streaming, whereas Turner, their current carriage is around cable, if it's not apples to apples, do those matching rights really apply? So it's a relationship question, it's a legal question, and that's where things stand at this moment. And I'm sure in a day or two or a week or two, it could look pretty different.
I think another key point there too, just around some of these sports rights deals, and is certainly tying that to the ad tiers, and not just the fact, of course, that you have big global audiences, but now that some of the streamers have these dual forms of monetization and they're better able to distribute some of these costs essentially and increase the returns through advertising. And it's still, of course, very early on the ad tiers basically for all the companies, but you can kind of see these ramping over time, and that will fuel more of the push to sports rights.
It's even more worrying for the linear guys because it just points out that big tech have so many other ways to monetize sports rights, content investments, whether it be advertising or just driving the overall ecosystem. That could be Amazon pushing customers more towards their retail business, or Apple just further locking in customers around the iPhone, which is just going to make the world harder for the legacy guys.
That's a good point. And I remember someone in the industry once saying to me that sports never make money on a direct basis, meaning no one ever made money on sports advertising. It's always what you do with those sports and drive on an adjacent basis. And you kind of think back once upon a time, right? Not even once upon a time, but currently, right? Sports are monetized through advertising, and then they're monetized by leveraging them in distribution deals. But then you also place content around sports, right? Use it as a lead-in. You launch a show after the Super Bowl or after a playoff game. And obviously the whole ecosystem now needs to find out, how are you going to do that in the world of streaming? And it's e-commerce, different types of possibilities are very interesting from here.
Yeah. And we're starting to see some of the legacy guys partner up with each other. So later on this year, we should see a sports JV, which is between ESPN, Fox, and Warner. It was announced recently that Disney and Warner are going to partner to bundle Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max together later this year. David, can you just talk about why they're doing this, and if you think this could potentially be a precursor to more aggressive consolidation?
Sure. Regarding the bundle that was just announced, so this will be at some point over the summer, consumers will have a way to purchase Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max, likely at a price point that would be attractive relative to buying those services individually, or if you wanted to buy Max plus the Disney Plus Hulu bundle. As far as the why, there's a few reasons. WBD, I thought, actually ran through this pretty good on their call last night. The first would be sub growth. So there's not total overlap between each of these platforms now. So to the extent you're a Disney Plus or a Max sub and you don't have the other one, this would be a way for you to cost effectively add the other service. Secondly, there's definitely some marketing efficiency here in terms of having two separate companies advertise what would be one offering. The real reason, though, is to limit churn, right? I talked about this earlier. The biggest challenge for the legacy services, much more so than Netflix, is managing churn, is managing people that come in to watch a single show or binge a show, and then as soon as they're done, they cancel the service. Now, if you offer a bundle and that's what people are subscribed to, it makes it much harder to cancel the service in that you're engaged in multiple points. That's especially true if you're a household, right? So maybe in a household, you have the kids watching Disney Plus and you have the adults watching Max. Previously, the kids might have been tired of watching some show on Disney and it would have been time to cancel it. But now the adults might say, well, you're not watching your Disney Plus show, but I am watching House of the Dragon or something like that. So we're not going to cancel the overall service. So it does serve to limit churn. Going to the question on consolidation, look, I think certainly there's a case to be made that for an industry that's under pressure and there probably being more DTC services available than the four or five that people want to subscribe to, there's certainly a case for consolidation, but that's obviously very complicated by regulatory matters. The fact that you have a lot of controlling shareholders over these legacy media companies, probably a good cast topic for another point.
Yeah, more to follow there. Doug, coming back to you, you talked about scale and how relevant that is as the media companies debate with the sports leagues. How important do you think global is in that perspective these days? Like, one of the COVID era bull cases for DTC versus linear media was the ease of taking US IP overseas, but it feels like that dynamic has shifted a little bit now. So what do you think there?
I would still say I think having global reach is very important in my view. Certainly there's just lots of examples where content has traveled beyond local countries, for example. So, I mean, certainly with Netflix strategy, there's local content in every market. But we've seen, if you take a piece of content like Squid Game, for example, which remains the most viewed, most popular piece of content ever for Netflix, that traveled, of course, extremely well globally, somewhat of a surprise type of hit. There have been a lot of others out of Europe, for example, that have done very well on a global basis. So I would say I think it's still quite important. And there's also a lot of opportunities there where that content is, where they can get really good return on content that in some cases may not really be that expensive to create and produce. So it's still quite important in my view.
And to that point, David, you cover TKO, who own WWE, you recently touched on it before, recently signed the deal with Netflix to take Raw early next year. How important was the global aspect of that as part of the negotiations?
Yeah, I think it was crucial for them, right? I mean, the way WWE had previously distributed its content around the globe was on a highly fragmented basis. Individual partners for most markets, rarely one of those partners would buy across multiple markets. That's complicated both from the standpoint in that they need to go and negotiate all these individual deals, or sometimes they have to go to a wholesaler, probably like IMG, and not necessarily get the best rate and then rely on their expertise to distribute the content. I think one of the things that TKO has talked about, and I think was attractive for them, is by having a singular partner, it arguably increases the awareness of the product in many of these markets from the standpoint of sponsorship, from the standpoint of a lot of other ancillary businesses that fuel them, like licensing, like consumer products. And I think over time, that's going to be what they point to as the most attractive part of the global piece of the Netflix deal, even beyond the immediate media rights payment.
Maybe to wrap up, we'll do a quick poll ahead of the Mike Tyson-Jake Paul fight coming this summer. David, who do you think?
Tyson, for sure.
Doug?
Same. Have to go with Tyson.
I'll go the other side. I'll say Jake Paul. I think he'll wear him down for the first few rounds, and then Tyson will struggle to keep up. I think he's 57 now, so.
Looks pretty young in the social media videos.
It's pretty scary in the social media videos. This has been great. Thank you everyone for tuning in, and we hope to see you next time. Thanks, David. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Research Recap. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll review, rate, and subscribe to JP Morgan's Making Sense to stay on top of the latest industry news and trends. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and YouTube. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan Research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2023, JP Morgan Chase & Co., all rights reserved.